From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Best-selling author A.J. Jacobs, who writes for Esquire magazine, is what they call an experimental journalist. He dives headfirst into his research. First, he read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. Then it was living a full year according to the Bible. Now he's been on a quest for perfect health, portion control, caveman workouts, limiting noise pollution, chewing blueberries for a very long time. A.J. Jacobs has tried it all, and he's here to share some tips. This hour, On Point, one man's quest to become drop-dead healthy. You can join the conversation. What methods have you tried to get in shape? What works? What doesn't? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Miami, A.J. Jacobs. He's editor-at-large at Esquire, author of the New York Times bestsellers The Year of Living Biblically, My Life is an Experiment, and The Know-It-All. His latest book is Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. A.J. Jacobs, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, John.
First of all, A.J., I have to ask you on the Drop Dead Healthy point. I'm in Boston, 27,000 people running the Boston Marathon in 80-degree temperatures. Is this prime weather for your book?
Well, I did just read an interesting study done by Stanford that said if you are exercise and you hold a cold bottle of water or cold thermos of water, it'll keep your core temperature down and it'll help with endurance and fatigue. So if there are people out there who are still running, then grab a cold bottle of water.
Before I get to the substance of your book, let me ask you about the form that your career as an author has taken. How did you propel yourself into this notion of experimental journalism and sort of living an idea to the extreme for a period of time and then writing about it?
Well, I've always been a fan of George Plimpton, who had joined sports teams and football. He'd get punched in the face by a heavyweight boxer. I thought this was a great way to convey the experience. What's it like? And I'm not a huge competitive athlete, but I thought maybe I can apply this to other things. So I started to dive into my projects and just live them, and I found it to be a fascinating way to explore a topic.
So Plimpton's year, for example, with the Detroit Lions that produced a book and a movie, Paper Lion, that was the inspiration for the approach in this trilogy that you've done?
Yeah, certainly one of them. I used to work at Entertainment Weekly magazine, and I looked like a now-forgotten actor named Noah Taylor, who was in a movie that at the time, this was 15 years ago, had gotten a lot of publicity and praise. And we found out he was not going to the Academy Awards, so everyone said, "You look exactly like him. You have to go in his place." So that was one of the first of these experiments where I went undercover. What's it like to be a movie star at the Oscars? And I got to tell you, it was great. You know, I got just the amount of positive feedback. You start to realize why these celebrities have the egos they do.
Now, did you always intend for the sequence of your books to be mind, spirit, body, the way this worked out? Because you also talked in your in the book about the role of an illness that you acquired on vacation in setting you on this last book.
Right. Yeah. The trilogy idea sort of came to me in the middle of all of these projects. But one of the reasons I undertook this was that 3 years ago, I was in terrible shape. I was what they call skinny fat. So my body looked like a snake that had swallowed a goat. And on top of that, as you mentioned, I got hospitalized with pneumonia. And my wife said to me, you know, I don't want to be a widow in my 40s. And so I said, all right, I'm going to get in shape, and if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go all in. I am going to test all the medical advice in the world and see what works and what doesn't. And I'm going to try to improve everything, diet, exercise, sleep, stress level, posture, sex, you name it.
This is the wife who used to refer to your stomach as Buddha?
That's right. She had a whole repertoire. You're 4 months pregnant, Buddha, Winnie the Pooh, you name it.
And talk a little bit about how you chose which fads, which sort of sets of advice or self-help to follow? Because it seemed as if you tried everything as opposed to taking one regimen and really trying that one all the way through.
That's it. I wanted to try as many things as possible just to experience them. I had a board of medical advisors, so I had doctors and nutritionists and trainers, and they gave me guidance. And I had a long
list. How often did you talk to the people on your board?
Oh, every day. I had this list of 70 pages of advice, health advice to try. So it was a 24/7 job because there's so much to do if you're going to be optimally healthy. You know, you have to exercise. You have to meditate. That's good for your brain. Pet dogs lowers the blood pressure. And you have to prepare food. You have to eat food, which if you're doing it properly, that takes quite a while because we need to chew. That was one of the big lessons I learned. We are a nation of under-chewers, and it may seem like a minor thing, but if you chew more, then you eat less and you get thinner. And there's actually a very passionate pro-chewing movement on the internet called Chewdyism, and they're a little excessive for my tastes, but I agree with their idea that you need to chew more.
Well, let's talk about that, because a bunch of the things that you tried in the book, which I was going through yesterday, seemed, you know, plainly mirthful or silly or whatever. But talk about Chewdyism. Is that something that, in fact, you take as a serious idea and explored in a semi-serious way?
Absolutely. I mean, what I tried to do is I did try to have fun and do some of the stranger things as well, but most of it, I was trying to look for evidence-based approaches. What does the science say actually works? And there is a good amount of evidence that chewing will make you healthier. There, you get a little more nutrition out of it, and it also slows down your eating. And as you might know, it takes 20 minutes for the stomach to send the message, I'm full, to the brain, which is pretty annoying that our bodies were designed that way. So it actually does help. I think mindful eating is one of the sort of trendier topics right now, and I think that it's a very powerful idea to be aware of what you're putting in your mouth, to be aware of as you're eating what you're doing.
Now, again, thinking about the approach that you took to exploring different methods of getting healthier, I noticed one of the reviews said that was critical of your book used the term shtick lit. Is shtick lit what you wanted to produce, and that was exactly the goal, or does that sound to you like an epithet?
I don't mind whatever people want to call it. I get called an experiential journalist, immersion journalist, method journalist, which I like. So yeah, you know, I'm not the first to, as I mentioned, George Plimpton had this approach, and I think it's a good way for the reader to actually feel like they're coming along on the journey with me.
Well, the ones who actually did come along with you on the journey, because they, of course, were living with you, were your wife and children. How did they react to the things that you were trying, the regimens you were imposing on yourself, and therefore, to some degree, on them?
Well, I think that they had mixed feelings. I mean, first of all, my previous book was called The Year of Living Biblically, and it was about how I tried to follow all the rules of the Bible. So that one was incredibly challenging for my wife. I grew a beard, for instance, because the Bible says you can't shave the corners of your beard. So I had this huge topiary on my chin, and she wouldn't even kiss me for the last 6 months of the project. So
that doesn't sound healthy.
Well, this is before the healthy one. Getting into shape compared to that was a big relief for her. But I did take things to the extreme, and she didn't enjoy that. I took her along on some of the adventures. I went to a popular exercise class in New York called Intensati, where it's aerobics combined with shouting affirmations. So you're doing your jumping and stepping, and then you scream, I'm the best, I'm the best, I can do it, I can do it, I can really, really do it. So that she did not like at all. She thought it was too Hare Krishna for her.
And what about your children? How old are your kids, and did they have an appreciation for what you were doing, or are they too young?
My kids, I have an 8-year-old, and I have twins who are 5, and they did have an appreciation. You know, one of the big lessons I learned is just how dangerous the sedentary life is, because, you know, it is really bad for your heart. And now,
as someone with 3 kids myself, you cannot have a sedentary life if you have 3 children.
There you go. It's very helpful, right? So, and I have 3 boys, and they are not sedentary creatures. Boys are not. So they were kind of an inspiration. They're always running around. So we've got to be more like them in that sense.
So were they rooting you on? Were they happy that you were engaging in this, or did they find parts of it embarrassing?
They were overall happy, but they also were annoyed because I wouldn't eat cupcakes, and that seemed to be a big part of their life.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with author A.J. Jacobs about his quest for perfect health. Now, some people think the line between fitness and fanaticism might be crossed in the Boston Marathon, which started today with runners all over the country and the world competing for the 116th time. Here's the sound of this morning's starting gunshot for the elite male runners.
Some of the fastest men in the world now racing toward Boston through these communities and in front of a crowd of 500,000 people.
A.J. Jacobs is with us today. He's the author of Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. Well, A.J., after a year spent researching this book, you should be one of those elite male runners, shouldn't you?
Well, marathons are, there's a big debate over how healthy marathons and triathlons are. And I did do a triathlon, but I think that marathons are very healthy in that they get people to exercise every day. That is the key, because if you have a goal, you're much more likely to exercise. But actually putting yourself, your body, through those 26 miles, the research is very mixed on what they're. It's clear from science there is a threshold at which exercise starts to damage your body, and we don't know exactly what that threshold is.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I'm a runner, have been for decades, but I've never gone the marathon route, in part because I've seen some of my friends run marathons and get injured. And then if you like to run, or you need to run, and then you get injured, it seems somewhat counterproductive.
There you go. I do run and work out every day, but I also try to incorporate exercise into every nook and cranny of my life. So I do what's called contextual exercise. So I'll take the stairs instead of the elevator. I will park in the far corner of a parking lot. I will literally run errands. I'll go run to the drugstore, pick up a tube of toothpaste, run back. When I'm talking to my kids, I will squat down to their level, to their eye level, and then pop back up. So that way I'm doing 50 or 60 squats a day.
Bad for the knees, isn't it?
What's that?
Bad for the knees, isn't it?
Not necessarily. Luckily, my knees are in good shape. If they start to hurt, then I'll take it back a notch.
All right, let's bring one of our callers into the conversation. We've got on the line Camille from Franklin, Massachusetts. Camille, drop dead healthy. What do you think?
Well, I'm finishing the last week of a paleo challenge. It's also called the caveman diet. And although I wouldn't subscribe to this diet for a lifestyle, I know there are a lot of people who do, I think that some of these so-called kind of crazy or faddish diets are great to shock us out of our system. This diet, you can't eat dairy, any kind of grains or sugar. And I'll probably continue 75% of my life doing it this way. But I realized I was addicted to carbs and to sugar, and the high and low that I would get is gone. I have a much more even energy level. So I think sometimes these diets that seem a bit crazy can be great for a 30-day period to change habits.
So, Camille,
it made me more mindful.
Camille, for those of us who are a little slow, what can you eat under this diet?
Well, you eat massive amounts of vegetables. So there's also no measuring. You can eat all the vegetables you want. Some proponents say don't eat many sweet potatoes. But then you eat meat and you eat some fruit. But I, instead of using butter, I use like coconut oil. And I replace a lot of things with almond flour instead of regular flour.
I actually tried the paleo diet, and I hung out with a lot of cavemen throughout my year. I think the paleo diet does have some good points. I agree about the idea of refined grain as being the devil. I think that that is a large part of the cause of our obesity epidemic. White grains, white bread, white rice, potatoes also. But I also think that they go a little farther than the evidence justifies on the idea of you got to get a lot of meat and protein in there. So I am I agree with them on the refined carbs. I have a more plant-heavy diet than that. So, but I think you're right. You can lose weight on the paleo diet. That is for sure. The long-term effects of the paleo diet on your heart, that is not yet clear.
AJ, do you agree with Camille that the paleo diet may have a useful effect in shocking your system initially and then you go off it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, any of those low-carb diets, if you are really obese, it's something to talk to your doctor about because that is a fast way to lose weight.
Let's go to another listener. Margaret from Belmont, Massachusetts. Margaret, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, John, and your guest. I am struck by, with all due respect, the extraordinary self-indulgence and practically narcissism of a life totally involved with yourself and your body. And where do the friendships come in? What about the psychic life? What about his wife and children? It's sort of my way or the highway. I would not want to be a part of that family at all. And it seems to me that there's a whole very, very rich part of life which involves interaction with others and emotional life. And
well, let me respond.
Margaret,
this.
Thanks so much for your call. AJ, what about
my
her
response
point?
Is, well, her point is interesting, but I think a little misguided because a huge part of being healthy is social interaction. It's not just about diet and exercise, and that is one of the big findings of this. So you have to maintain friends and a close social network. That is hugely tied
and pet
to
your dog.
Longevity. And also, the idea that there is an idea that being healthy is tied to vanity, and if you're really obsessed with your looks, that is true. But the studies show that if you're healthy and happy, you are more involved with the community. You are more likely to help other people. So it's actually quite the opposite.
Let me ask you how you selected the range of activities to explore and chronicle, because you talked in your book about not just diet and exercise, which are the things that I think come first to mind for most people, but noise, toxins in the environment, sex, interaction with you talked about the stress relief that comes from petting your dog. How did you figure out what spheres you were going to explore?
Well, as you say, I didn't want to just focus on diet and exercise. I wanted to address all parts of our body, and it was surprising that certain areas have a huge impact on your health that we don't even think about. You brought up noise pollution. That one to me is fascinating because we all know it's bad for your ears, and we all know that the world is getting incredibly noisy. But I don't think a lot of people realize how bad noise is for your heart. There are a lot of studies out there that one, for instance, says that people who work in noisy environments have a 2 to 3 times higher rate of fatal heart attacks. So there is a really important part of your life. It's very important to try to maintain some quiet in your life for your health and for your mental health.
Talk about some of the most exotic treatments or approaches that you explored. We heard from Camille earlier about the paleo challenge, the caveman diet, and I read about your experiences with the caveman movement and throwing boulders around, and maybe you should carry a heavy log over your shoulder when you're walking around the city. What are some of the other things that most people would never have heard of that you found to some degree useful or at least interesting enough to try?
As you mentioned, the caveman workout where you you throw boulders and run around Central Park. I thought that was lovely. It was a lot of fun. It's not something I do regularly. The one thing I will say about it is it's outside, and there are studies that show that just being outside lowers your stress level. So I did that. I mean, I did all sorts. I did colonics and juice cleanses, which I actually did not like on either end, and luckily for me, the science backs me up here.
Not because they were unpleasant or because you thought they were ineffective?
Both. I mean, I was talking about unpleasant, but it turns out the science says they're ineffective. You don't need to detoxify your body. Your body detoxifies just fine by itself. So that was an interesting experience, but one I probably won't be duplicating.
What else in the exotic realm?
There was one. I don't want to go into too much detail, but I was very shocked to find out that I had been going to the bathroom incorrectly for 40 years because our bodies were built to squat, not to sit. So that was quite a stunning change.
Okay, I think we're going to go to another listener at this point. Fran from Virginia Beach, Virginia, is on the line. Fran, welcome to On Point.
Hi, this is Fran. Hi, John. I had to laugh after what he just got through saying. I had to call today because I ran Boston actually 30 years ago when I was 50. I just wanted to...
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome. I just want to make a point that some of us have always been healthy. I've just always been healthy. I'm turning 80 in January. I ride my bike 7,000 miles a year.
Wow.
I've played tennis, and I've just always been healthy. I know some of that has to do with genes, I'm sure.
You think you're just lucky?
I guess so. I'm not fanatical about what I eat. The one thing I just stay away from, and I think would be a good idea to stay away from, is French fries. I mean, that's just a vehicle to get fat into your system, I think. But other than that, I take no medications at all. Never see the doctor. So anyway, some people stay healthy all their lives.
That's great.
Congratulations. I wish millions and millions of people could share that experience. AJ, what about French fries? Is that a uniquely destructive food that people need to stay away from?
It's pretty bad. It's got salt. It's got a lot of fat and potatoes.
But it's my favorite thing to eat.
Oh, I know. You know what? Well, I think Michael Pollan has the right idea. You can eat French fries as long as you make them, because making them takes a long time. It's not easy. So if you only do that, then you're not going to be eating a lot of French fries.
Let's go to Skip from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Skip, thanks for joining us on the program.
Hi, John.
Go ahead, Skip.
John, I'm just interested in your thoughts about the similarities and differences between health and fitness.
Skip, it sounds like you're running right now.
I am running right now.
Fantastic.
The difference between health and fitness, so many people say he was fit, he shouldn't have had that heart attack, when in fact they're close cousins, but they're different. They're not the same. Jim Fix died of a heart attack. He was in great shape. George Shaheen, I think that was his name, cardiologist, advisor to Runner's World, died of prostate cancer. Probably, I'm just guessing, he never had his PSA checked. I had a good friend who was in just brilliant shape, rode a bike every day, and now has an ostomy because of colon cancer, and never had a colonoscopy. So perhaps draw out the differences and similarities between the two, and I'll listen offline.
Skip, enjoy your run, and that's my favorite call of the day, somebody right in tune with the subject of the program. AJ, what is the difference between fitness and health?
It's a very interesting question because I actually thought about this a lot. This is why I did not do a lot of exercise for the first 40 years of my life. I use what I call the gym fix argument, which is that, yeah, you can run every day and still die of a heart attack at age 52. You never know when death is going to get you. But I actually think
isn't that a prescription for being neither fit nor healthy?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I came to the conclusion that is a bit of a cop-out because you cannot control everything. You can control some things in your health, but you can't control everything. But there are benefits to being healthy and in shape aside from longevity. It makes exercise makes you smarter. It makes you focus more. It makes you more involved in the community. And it makes you feel better. Your energy level is higher. So that is why I've continued doing exercise, not just for the longevity. But he's right. You know, one of the big points of the book is that, you know, you can't control it all. And one of my close relatives who was one of the healthiest people I've ever met, or at least most obsessed with health. She was a raw food veganist, and she did Tai Chi, and she was obsessed with keeping all toxins out of the house, no microwaves, not even cell phones. And sadly, at the end of my project, she contracted leukemia and died shortly after. So,
well, AJ, I want to talk about your Aunt Marty in the next segment, but let me ask you about the gym fix example, because I think many, many people are aware of that. What happened with gym fix?
Well, you know, it's hard to know, but they say that heart disease ran in his family. You know, there's always going to be outliers. In general, exercise does lengthen your life. So there's always going to be gym fixes who die early, but in general, it will lengthen your life.
And was it your impression from the research that you did that exercise, that of all the things that you explored in the realm of diet, exercise, and other aspects of life, that exercise was the most important, is the most important for health and longevity?
Well, it's hard to rank. I mean, diet, exercise, stress, I think, is hugely important, and social connectivity. These are sort of the four basic pillars. And in terms of, I think there are a lot of myths about exercise. Exercise is actually not the best way to lose weight. That definitely is diet. But exercise has many other benefits besides weight loss.
And of the behaviors that you explored and have kept as a part of your life since this project, what are the most important ones?
Well, one is just self-tracking, the idea of keeping track of your numbers, because the more you follow your own numbers, the healthier you will behave. So even something as simple as getting a pedometer, that will make you walk more. And I actually work on a treadmill desk. I wrote this book on a treadmill.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with author A.J. Jacobs about his new book, Drop Dead Healthy. He's a New York Times bestselling author and editor-at-large of Esquire magazine. A.J., we're going to go to another listener, Velma from Cookeville, Tennessee. Velma, welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. Thank you for my call. I just have one comment, and it made one of your gentlemen who answered the phone laugh, so I'll make it. It has to do with the arrogance of these people who are apparently not dealing with much in the way of physical problems. And because of that, I think if they did a little more thank you, God, and a little less preaching to those of us who cannot follow their recommendations that seem to us rather stupid.
Velma, do you have limitations on your own ability to exercise?
I've had it for 25 years. I'm extremely healthy. My doctors say I'm very good about working through pain and all that kind of stuff. But that isn't the point. A caveman diet won't do a darn thing for me. This is something genetic. It's familial. And it's a lot to do with the cards you're dealt and dealing with it, honey.
Well, so. Velma, it sounds like you're dealing with it very effectively. Good luck to you, and thanks for calling. AJ, what about Velma's point? She and we got a message on Facebook from another listener who found it a little off-putting to hear all these prescriptions when maybe everybody can't follow them.
Well, you know, that was one of the points in my book. You can't do everything. And as I talked about, it's a lot about the luck of the draw. You cannot control everything, like my Aunt Marty, who died of leukemia. What I recommend is that there are many small fixes you can make that will have a big impact on your life. So something just as simple as trying to stand up every hour and walk around for a couple of minutes, that makes a big difference. Chewing your food, that can make a big difference. So, I certainly would not say everyone should be doing everything. That would be overkill. And in fact, there is an idea that you can be too obsessed with health, and that is not healthy. I interviewed a doctor who—
Well, you certainly tested the limits of that.
I did. Well, that's one of the conclusions, that you've got to have balance in your life. If you're at the gym for 14 hours a day, then you're ignoring your friends and your family. So that, I actually don't go to the gym very often, but I try to exercise with my kids, play basketball with them, or even use them as barbells. They like that. I think that I interviewed a doctor who said that he had come up with a new type of eating disorder called orthorexia. And this is he defines it as being unhealthily obsessed with healthy food. Because if you're so obsessed with finding just the right locally grown quinoa, and that's to the exclusion of going out with friends to restaurants, that's not healthy. So there is a limit.
All right, AJ, we'll bring in another caller, Paul from Ontario, across the border in Canada. Paul, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, John.
What's your comment?
I have a contribution and a question. With respect to the contribution, about sound pollution being detrimental, I found these earplugs that I wear when I attend live music. It cuts about 20 dB out and maintains fidelity. And so I bought them for music listening, but I find that I wear them in public places because, often it's between 80 and 90 dB, and that's pretty close to ear damage, and it helps me feel relaxed when commuting or whatever. And then the question I have is, I went through a stressful period for many years due to a health issue in our family, and I experienced probably a lot of cortisol in my system. Do you know of a way to help your body recover from that overexposure to cortisol?
Paul, thanks so much for your call. AJ, do you know of a way?
Let me just address the first point. I'm glad he brought up earplugs, because I actually tested a bucket full of earplugs to find the best. And the one that worked best for me is, it was originally designed for law enforcement and military, so it's pretty hardcore, but it's also quite comfortable, and they're called Surefire Sonic Defenders, so in case anyone wants to pick those up. And secondly, in terms of stress, he's absolutely right. I think stress has a huge impact on our immune system and on aging. So I think the key is just to reduce stress. There's nothing you can do about stress that has already happened in your life, but trying to be, again, with the social connections is a huge part of reducing stress. I also tried various methods. I went to a laughter club. There's a growing movement. There are thousands of them now. And you just go into a room with a bunch of strangers and you laugh for an hour. And this lowers your stress level. And there is some evidence that it does. There's not a huge amount of science behind it. But
I have to say, when I read that in your book, that sounded like one of the sillier tangents. Did you find it that way yourself?
You know what? I do not go on. I do not do that on a regular basis, but it works for some people, and so I'm certainly not going to denigrate it. And you know, it was for me in the beginning. It was actually more stressful because forcing yourself to laugh is, you know, that's kind of stressful. But by the end, I was actually getting into it. I sort of I drank the Kool-Aid and I was laughing genuinely and felt a little better afterwards.
And what exactly was in the Kool-Aid that you drank?
There was no actual Kool-Aid, no beverages and no jokes. You were supposed to just go in there and laugh.
All right, let's go to another caller, George from Buffalo, New York. George, thanks so much for joining On Point. What's your question or comment?
I've got two questions. One is, did you read the China study? And if you did, what kind of impact did that have on your year-long journey? And the other question is, how long did it take you to read the encyclopedia?
George, thanks so much for your call. AJ, take the second one first and then talk about the China study if you did read it.
Yeah, the it took me about a year and a half to read the encyclopedia. I read it from A to Z, and all 44 million words, and it was a wonderful experience. I got to spend time with the most fascinating people in history, and I'm very sad because, you know, recently the Britannica announced they're not going to continue printing the print version, so I sat shiva for a while on that. As for the
You don't have an iPad?
Well, I do have an iPad, but there is something lovely about the actual physical books. And now I'm not a Luddite, so I do go along with the technology. But it was a sad watershed. In terms of the China study, yes, absolutely, I read it, and you know, it represents one pole in the nutrition community. There's the China study basically says no animal fats, no animal products whatsoever, no meat, no eggs, no dairy. That is the way to ultimate health. And it's based on a huge longitudinal study in China. So that's on one end. And then on the other end, you have people like Gary Taubes, who's an excellent journalist, who says that, no, it's all about the carbs. It's sort of similar to the paleo diet, that the simple carbs are what is making us fat, and it's okay to have meat, that the whole idea of cholesterol and fat is misguided. I think that the bulk of the evidence right now is on the side of the plant-heavy diet. That has, in terms of the number of studies, that has the support. I think that the China study, from a lot of the nutritionists I talked to, it goes beyond the evidence. It extrapolates a little too far that all animal products are bad. So for me, for instance, I rarely eat meat. I don't eat meat. I eat fish and eggs and a lot of nuts to get my protein. But I am a mostly plant diet.
Let's go to Ben from Wallingford, Connecticut. Ben, thanks for calling into the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. I just wanted to mention something that AJ mentioned earlier about incorporating exercise into your daily routine. And I think I would almost go one step further and say that the more we get out of our cars and either walk or bike where we're going and do whatever, that not only has advantages to our own health in the exercise that we get, but advantages to everyone else's in lowering the air pollution and preventing traffic deaths and just making places and communities and our world a better place to live. And I wondered if AJ had any comments on that.
AJ?
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think when you're walking, when you're in your car, you're in a little bubble, so you're not interacting with other people. And when you're walking, you might be able to run into other people. And as I mentioned, I try to walk as much as possible or run errands, and I love working on my treadmill desk. It actually makes me more focused and less fatigued. So people say, you know, it seems odd, like, how can you do that? And believe me, I am not coordinated, so if I can do it, then I think almost everyone can.
AJ, let's go to another caller. We've got Jennifer from Boston. Jennifer, welcome to the show. What's your question for AJ?
Hi, John. AJ, I was just curious. I love the idea of, you know, the laughing exercise and just sort of everything. Try, you know, health as far as trying everything. And I was just curious to know what your sexual health, did that change? Did your relationship with your wife become enhanced?
That's a great question.
There Jennifer, is a thanks for the question. AJ, if your wife doesn't mind, can you answer that question?
Yeah, I won't go into too much detail. But yeah, there is a chapter on sex because sex overall is healthy. It's good for your heart and it lowers stress levels. And there is even one study that says that it helps cure hiccuping. So I say overall sex is healthy. It's not clear exactly how much sex is healthy. The doctors won't give you an exact number, but I did feel that I would try to improve my sex life. We have three young kids, so there's a limit to how far that can go. But I tried all sorts of aphrodisiacs like asparagus, peanut butter, chocolate. They say that these all work. But you know what? The science says that food is really not the way to is really not an effective aphrodisiac. The only effective aphrodisiac really is testosterone and dopamine. And the best way to get those going, aside from testosterone shots, if you want to go that way, is to do something exciting with your partner. Go to an exotic restaurant or go to an unusual vacation, something novel. That gets the dopamine flowing and that gets you in the mood.
AJ, let's talk a little bit about the bottom line. You spent a year on this project. Talk about the results in terms of how you felt, how your body looked, your weight, your body mass, the fat content of your body, all that stuff.
Yeah, it did work. I lost weight. I lost about I no longer look like I'm 4 months pregnant. My body fat went down from 17.
I don't know how long it's been since you actually completed the research, but have you kept the weight off?
I have kept the weight off. I think mostly because I'm walking so much. Thank God. I lost a lot of body fat. You know what? One of the biggest changes, though, for me is the level of energy. I feel that I have I used to be much more lethargic. So that's good. But I should, I hesitate to say all this because, then tomorrow I'm going to get rickets or something horrible. So because as we discussed, health, there's a lot of luck in it. You can't control everything. You can just do your best.
But do you have the hot stuff before and after pictures? I know you sort of discredited that idea at the beginning of the book with how easily those things can be faked. But do you have some good ones?
Yeah, I do. I definitely took the before and after, and thank God the after looks a lot better than the before.
Without
Photoshop.
With a more a serious note at the end, I found it very moving at the end of your book to read about what happened with your Aunt Marty and your experience of losing your grandfather. Talk a little bit about those experiences on a personal level and how that changed the way you thought about the research that you were doing.
Yeah, well, my grandfather was a remarkable man, and he died at the age of 96, right at the end of my project. And he taught me that one of the keys to longevity, and the evidence bears this out, is to remain active and involved. Even in his 90s, he was sending emails, starting projects, still doing business. He never really retired. And to me, I found this very inspirational because that really is one of the, you got to stay passionate. You got to have a reason for waking up. Even if you retire, that's fine, but you got to have a passion.
And you were also inspired by your Aunt Marty's optimism.
That's true. I mean, she, although she died, she believed that what she did was good, and that living healthy provided benefits for her, both ethically and physically, that outweighed the fact that that made it that was a goal in itself, health for health's sake.
So, are you done with the experimental genre, or what's next following the completion of the trilogy?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't. I usually wait a couple months before after a book comes out to try it. I get a huge number of suggestions from readers on what I should do next. One of the most popular is that my wife and I should try all of the positions in the Kama Sutra. But my wife put the kibosh on that, and I'm actually happy. That is not one I want to do. Even with my new body, I don't think I have the flexibility.
Is the book selling well?
Yes, it is. It's very selling well, and I just got a lovely review in your newspaper, the New York Times, that said it was bright, funny, and useful. So
I saw it. AJ Jacobs, congratulations on the book. Thanks for being with us. AJ Jacobs is editor at large of Esquire and author of the new book, Drop Dead Healthy: One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.